Thank you, everyone. Please be seated. Good morning. Regional plan dealing with point source discharges. If you're here for something else, you're probably meant to be in another hearing room. I'll just run through and check to see that we've got all the parties who've indicated that they wish to be heard for this part of the hearing. Regional Council, Mr. Conway and Mr. Fisher, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
See the Director General is here. Thank you, Ms. Timon. OG, Ms. Chappell, good morning. Otorohanga District Council have submissions to be taken as read. Is there representation today?
Sir, I have instructions from Ms. McIntosh for Otorohanga District Council.
Thank you.
And confirm the position as you've outlined. I also appear for Manamata Piangu District Council. Sir, I have my junior here, Mr. Cassidy. With your leave, I seek leave to be excused from the hearing, and he'll remain for the morning, at least, until OG's case is in the
house. Certainly. Well, leave to come and go generally applies on the usual conditions, which are that council who wish to leave need to make their own arrangements to make sure that they're here when they need to be.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr.
I take it, sir, though, that the submissions which we filed are in support of Mr. Muldowney's position, very brief, and I doubt if there's anything arising from them.
Well, yes, I mean, We're hearing from the various councils in a sequence.
Yes.
We are expecting that council will recognise what is in common.
Yes.
And mainly focus, after perhaps we've heard from Mr. Muldowney, mainly focus on any points of difference or any additional matters that particularly affect a separate council.
There's nothing in that category for Matter or O'Drama. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Green. And then Waipa, Mr. Malone, good morning.
Good morning, Your
Honour. Genesis Energy. Yes, Ms. Garvin, thank you.
And I'm appearing with Ms. Tadetor.
Thank you.
Genesis, thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Garvin. Bathurst Resources and BT Mining filed written submissions separately. Is there an appearance this morning for Bathurst? But we're taking those submissions in as they stand. Fonterra and Dairy New Zealand, Mr. Minhinnick.
Just Fonterra, Your Honour. Dairy New Zealand doesn't have a role in this.
A role in this, all right, thank you. Fish and Game, Ms. Ongley, good morning. Thank you. The River Iwi, Mr. Ferguson, not yet. All right, there's no other representation for the River Iwi? No. And Waikato River Authority. Mr. Ryan and Ms. Bulow, perhaps coming next week when they're scheduled. Is there any other party present expecting to be heard today or tomorrow who I haven't called on? Mr. Muldowney, I didn't call on you. Why did I pass over you?
I'm not sure, sir, but I appear...
Hamilton City, Tauhou, South Waikato.
Yes, Ms. Thomas, sir, thank you.
I think I got so excited by the submissions being made by Mr. Green that that must cover everything to do with local authorities. My apologies, Mr. Muldowney. Any other party then? No. We have a hearing schedule which I think has been circulated to everyone. Hopefully that works for everyone. We are aware that there are certain people who are observing through VNR. There are certain people who certain witnesses who may be heard and cross-examined by VNR, ABL, and hopefully all of those arrangements will be reasonably straightforward. Are there any particulars in terms of the schedule of the hearing that are of concern to anyone or that anyone wants to point out to us? No. Very good. Well, we also have, as I call on you now, Mr. Conway, a memorandum which helpfully seeks to summarise the issues. And but presumably you're going to follow up on any matters, the particular matters that the regional council wants to make. And just excuse me, let me see if there's a mouse. Registrar, if there's a spare mouse somewhere, I'd be grateful. But don't wait for me. Mr. Conway, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honour.
Now, could I just ask you maybe to shift and move to the centre where we have the text-to-speech microphone set up?
Yes,
or you can move that closer to you. Yes? Either or.
Not sure if it's close enough, but...
Mr. Hudson, if he moves it to that location, is that going to be sufficient?
It should be okay, sir.
Thank you very much.
I use my outside voice.
Here's my
assist.
Ah, okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honour. Now, the legal submissions that we filed before the earlier part of the hearing commenced have a section in them on point source discharges. It was section 17, which starts on page 37 of those submissions. And my intention with opening this morning was to take you through that. It's a brief section, and then simply highlight the memo that we filed on Friday, which was an attempt to capture the issues in dispute. And perhaps with my friends for Fish and Game and the Department or the Director General of Conservation, who subsequently filed memoranda clarifying and narrowing or adding an issue here and there on that. And our hope was that memo would serve to make the issues in dispute relatively crisp and to assist the court on the way through.
Thank you.
So, moving to part 17 of my earlier legal submissions, this hearing relates to point source discharges, which are largely dealt with in Objective 3, but also policies 11 to 14. The point source discharge policies apply when considering resource consent applications for point source discharges of the four contaminants. However, as explained earlier in those submissions, PC1 does not include any rules relating to point source discharges, and rules that trigger resource consent requirements for those activities are included elsewhere in the regional plan. Now, Your Honour, I'd like to interpolate here and just touch on, or give you perhaps a very brief orientation to the other parts of the regional plan that deal with point source discharges, because that context is important for understanding how the objectives and policies fit in, as well as for the fact that the rules are contained in that other chapter. Now, before the hearing commenced, the common bundle that was filed, an electronic form, contains a copy of the regional plan in its entirety, and that's at volume 501.0537. Now, we don't have a hard copy of that available, but if you have the electronic bundle in front of you, I'd be grateful if we could just go there and I'll step through some points at a high level to orientate court to that. And the page I wish to start on is 501.0546 in that common bundle.
Yes, all right. Table of contents.
Yes, thank you, sir. So you'll see there that table of contents in volume, there's volume 1 on that first page and volume 2 over the page. And module 3 there is the water module, partway down the page. And you'll see that contains 10 chapters at present, including some overall chapters on water resources. Chapter 3.5 is the discharges chapter, so that's existing in the regional plan at present. And then chapter 3.9 deals with non-point source discharges. The chapter that this plan change is about would add chapter 3.11 at the end here, so that's already on the table. Now, what I wanted to do very briefly is to step through a couple of components of the discharges chapter, but first to go to the chapter 3 table of contents, which is on page 501.0600.
Yes.
So that goes through and sets out under each of those same chapter names an indication of what's in each of the chapters. This is the water resources, chapter 3.1 overall, and then you'll see under discharges at the end of that page there's an issue objective policies and a range of implementation methods which include rules. If we step down now to objective 3.1.2, which is 8 pages on 501.0608. You will see the overarching objective, one of the key overarching objectives for water management, and it's a broad one that covers a range of matters that I don't intend to take you through in detail, but essentially it's about management of water bodies, and the matters that are sought to be ensured are in paragraphs A through to Q. And they include some matters that are relevant to the question of Objective 3 and how enabling it might need to be by way of particularly paragraph P, which deals with positive effects of water resource use activities and associated existing lawfully established infrastructure being recognised while avoiding remedy or mitigating adverse effects on the environment. So when it comes to things like existing infrastructure that parties to this proceedings have, that's relevant to those as well as the Chapter 3.11 Objective 3, which is up for debate in this hearing. And the reason I touch on that is essentially to make the point that Chapter 3.11 is not self-contained. It doesn't need to do everything that the RMA requires because some of the components are contained in these other provisions. So that's why it's important to read in that context.
Is everything contained in Chapter 3 of the Regional Plan, or are there other general provisions that you would say bear on the framework?
None that I wish to draw your attention to today, Your Honour. It may be that Mr. Trevelco can point you to other components that are important, but the other modules... there are approaches to resource management in the first module. The second is matters of significance to Māori. Now, at an overarching level, that is clearly going to be relevant here, albeit that module has not sought to go into the matters related to Te Tiriwhaimana that this plan change is endeavouring to achieve. The other modules, for example, land and soil and air and geothermal, relate to other subject matters. So they're less directly relevant here.
And just noting that in terms of the objectives which are outlined at 3.1.2 of the document you're taking us through, it doesn't talk about restoration, does it?
No, not at that point, sir. And that's part of the reason why a specific chapter was endeavoured to be developed that can deal with that. Now, if we step down to part 3.2, page 501.0614, we see there, this is management of water resources. The objective simply refers back to two previous objectives, including the one that I took you to before. And in terms of policies, this is a more general policy about managing water bodies to enable a range of water use activities while ensuring a net improvement is achieved. And again, in paragraph E, that deals with recognising positive benefits to established infrastructure. Policy 8, over a couple of pages, is about reasonable mixing. That's one that witnesses have referred to in their evidence, so when we get to the aspects to do with reasonable mixing, that's the one that people have been talking about. And then over in 3.5, chapter 3.5, which starts on page 501.0692, that relates to discharges. And there is a list at the start about the particular types of discharges it relates to. And then the objective is 3.5.2 at the bottom of that page, and it's a fairly high-level objective as well, and includes reference back to objective 3.1.2, which we've already been to. So there's a degree of linking between these different parts already. And then over the page, policy 1, enabling discharges to water that will have only minor adverse effects. And policy 2, managing discharges to water with more than minor adverse effects. So those are the two policies that currently set up, two of the key policies that set up the rule framework, which we'll touch on briefly, and then I'll be done with this. The general discharge rules start at page 501.0696. And there are three of them there. The chapter has some rules that relate to particular types of discharges, but wastewater discharges, for example, municipal ones, don't have their own specific topic-based rules, so they're dealt with by these three rules here. There is a permitted activity rule, which relates to discharges of water into water, where there are no adverse effects. So therefore, in municipal wastewater discharges, for example, it would be rule, discretionary rule 3.5.4.5, which is at a broad level. Because it's discretionary and broad, that's how it can easily fit in with Chapter 3.11, because it's the matters in Chapter 3.11 that can guide the consideration of such an application without needing a new rule. Now, at this point, I'm intending to move away from those provisions and back to my submissions. But in case there are any questions on any of that, I'm happy to take those now or shortly when I come. Returning to paragraph 17.2 of my legal submissions, policy 11 provides for the continued operation and development of regionally significant infrastructure and regionally significant industry subject to policies 12 and 13 and having regard to the need to achieve objective 1. And as you see from the issues list, there are issues between some parties as to whether or how the relationship with objective 1 and policies 12 and 13 should be specified, and I've set out there the reasons of the parts of Mr. Trebilco's evidence where he addresses that. Policy 12 is a key policy for the point source discharges. It requires them to represent the best practicable option to prevent or minimise the adverse effects of the discharge. It also provides a framework for proposing measures to offset or compensate for any remaining residual adverse effects of the discharge. So this is a bespoke policy for offsetting and compensation to take it away from what's in the policy 5 dealing with those matters in relation to non-point source discharges. And I've set out there the issues between the parties include whether and how reasonable mixing should be provided for and whether a cross-reference to section 107.2 is appropriate. Policy 13 requires consideration of a discharge's contribution to contaminant loads and impact on achievement of the target attribute states and lists matters that should be taken into account. Key issue there is the same one about whether that policy should be subject to policy 12. And then policy 14 sets out matters to be had regard to when determining an appropriate duration for any consent granted for a point source discharge. So again, instead of policy 7, which we've spoken about in earlier parts of the hearing, when dealing with a point source discharge consent application, it's policy 14 that is relevant. And issues between the parties include whether the reference to regionally significant infrastructure should include municipal stormwater systems and networks. And again, interpolating briefly, and then I'll be done. Regional Council has worked very hard to narrow down the issues that were in dispute between the parties at the outset. There's been reasonable focus to mediation and also conferencing, as well as other discussions between the parties. And to that end, there is now a significantly greater degree of alignment between the parties in both of the point source provisions, which I hope is, as you can see, and is reflected in that issues list that we filed. Those issues are, in some cases, matters of drafting, in some cases, matters of policy preference. Obviously, they're there because they're important to parties. But what I would say about a lot of those issues is that they have been the subject of quite a few discussions, and the witnesses' views are fairly clear and well explained in your evidence. And so, in my submission, they are, to a large extent, matters of submission. And I just wish to signal at this point that, as a result, the Regional Council is intending to take a fairly focused and efficient approach to cross-examination over the next 2 days in order largely to allow the parties to explain and elaborate on those matters that that are of importance to them, I guess, because time's precious always, and in this part of the hearing in particular, and it seems that might be a useful way to proceed rather than delve into lengthy discussions about assist versus enable in such matters.
Well, yes, I mean, a leading case in relation to the interpretation of plans in which I suffered a quite grievous defeat does make it very clear that the text and interpretation of a statutory planning document ultimately is a matter of law. The complicating factor is that you still need evidence in order to understand what the words of a plan in a plan change or plan review case what those words ought to be. So there's no bright line, I think, between the two. But thank you for noting that that will be your focus, and it will be good if everyone, both counsel and witnesses, can just observe the standard rule about who makes submissions and who gives evidence.
Thank you, Your Honour. Now, at this point, I was intending to call Mr. Trevilco. I'm going to take that memorandum I filed on Friday as read. It may be a useful guide as we go through. Certainly, it's going to guide the questions I do have for witnesses.
Yes.
And to the extent it's already been narrowed down by the memorandum that Fishing Game and the Director General have filed, that's been helpful for my understanding of where parties sit, but it has been helpful to be able to prepare that based on legal submissions that were filed last week.
Certainly. Will you be leading Mr. Trevilco much, if at all?
I wasn't intending to, sir. Is it partly because the matters that are addressed here are well traversed and are set out in the evidence already?
Thank you.
But if there are matters that would be helpful to hear from him initially, I'm happy to do so.
Well, no, I think that exactly as you say, I suspect that everyone who's here is very clear about why they're here and what information they're seeking. So let's just get on with it.
I just wanted to clarify that Fish and Game hasn't filed an additional memorandum.
I was going to check on that in due course.
Yes.
I mean, we've got various bits and pieces. I don't think we need to try to get all the paperwork in order right now, but at some stage, we do have your submissions in relation to this, so we'll focus on that.
I've advised the other parties a couple of minor changes
yes.
to the provisions, and I'll outline those when I give legal submissions.
Thank you very much.
My apologies, and I see now that that memorandum, or the document that was sent round was not sent to the court, so I apologise for the confusion I've introduced.
So we're missing out.
You are at present.
All right. Hopefully for a good reason.
Thank you, Mr. Honour. I now call Mr. Trevilco.
Thank you.
Sincerely and truthfully declare and affirm that the evidence you're about to give to the court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Good morning, Mr. Trevilco.
Good morning.
Could you please confirm your full name is Erwin Mark Trevilco?
Yes, it is.
And you've prepared three statements of evidence in these proceedings, a statement of evidence in chief, supplementary statement and evidence and rebuttal, and the first of those sets out your qualifications and experience.
Yes.
And you've participated in expert conferencing specifically on the subject of point source discharges and signed a conferencing statement to that effect.
Yes.
Do you have any corrections to make to your evidence?
No.
Do you confirm it is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes.
Thank you. Now, would you now please answer any questions from my friends in the bench?
Now, in terms of the order in which I call on counsel to cross-examine, what we've been doing so far in the hearing is following essentially the order of hearing of parties. It does mean that there's been a little bit of back and forth in terms of the positions that people are taking, but it has been reasonably straightforward, and again, in a plan change case, I don't know that there's too much either to be gained or lost. I'm trying to rearrange things. That would mean, Ms. Chappell, I'd be calling on you first. And I'd work on through roughly in the order in which I went through earlier about who was present, except in this case I try not to overlook the district councils, Mr. Mildown. Is there any party that has any issue with the court adopting that order? No? Ms. Chappell. Yes, if you have to use that lectern, or close to that lectern.
Good morning, Mr. Trilfan.
Good morning.
Just a couple of general questions to kick things off. First question, is it fair to say, in your view, that policies 11, 12 and 13 are reasonably complex policies when you read them together?
Yes, I guess they are.
And each of those policies effectively starts in the same way, doesn't it? So it starts with the words when considering a resource consent application.
Yes.
And the intent underlying those policies is to ensure that rivers are restored and protected, is that your understanding?
Yes.
And to be consistent with the objectives, point source discharges must achieve the interim target attribute state, mustn't they?
They are part of the journey to achieving the interim target attribute state.
Yes, and there's reference in those policies to achieving those target states. So, as a general proposition, to do that, existing industry or infrastructure is going to have to keep improving the quality of its discharges, isn't it?
As a general point, yes.
Yeah. And you would accept that a continuous improvement approach has been applied to regionally significant industry and infrastructure for at least since the inception of the RMA?
Yes, general.
And with existing industry and replacement discharges, it's just going to be a continuation of that continuous improvement approach, but perhaps with a greater emphasis on achieving those interim target attribute states.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it is more targeted policy that we have now for those kinds of discharge consents.
Yes. So my questions to you are largely going to focus on replacement discharge consents, because obviously that is the aspect that has always been of significance to my client. So if we could apply that lens perhaps to my questions as we go through. So the first thing I want to ask you about is the policies in the regional policy statement that you have referred to. And I'd like you, if you could please, pull up the regional policy statement. And I'm looking for tab 8. It's 501.0249.
Do we have that here?
Yes, it's the electronic version.
Starts on 0194.
Sorry, which policy?
So that's IMP4 relating to regionally significant industry and primary production.
Yes.
And you haven't listed that policy in your evidence, but would you agree that this policy is also relevant to PC1, particularly with respect to the point source discharge provisions and regionally significant industry?
Yes.
Thank you. At paragraph 218 of your evidence in chief, and you might like to pull that out, that's at reference 301.0516.
Sorry, what's that, 218?
Paragraph 218,
yes.
And then you say that policy 11 provides for the continued operation of regionally significant infrastructure.
Yes.
And regionally significant industry, thereby supporting objective 3 while achieving objectives 1 and 2 as required by section 32 of the RMA.
Yes.
So is it fair to say that you see a clear link between policy 11 and the objectives?
The objectives in the regional plan?
Yes. And in the same way as other policies give effect to objectives, but without necessarily mentioning them, that 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 is what happens with respect to policy 11?
Yes.
So I'd like to ask you a couple of questions with respect to Objective 3 and this issue that arises around the words enable versus assist.
Yes.
And firstly, would you agree that assist and enable are probably synonyms?
I don't think they're synonyms. Synonyms, I think, are a little bit different.
Yes. Okay. Fair enough. Would you agree that enable is a word that is used in Section 5 of the RMA?
Yes, I do, but it's used in a way that is subject to Part 5, A, B, and C, so it's not on its own in terms of enabling the well-beings.
No, and this objective isn't on its own in terms of enabling the well-beings or assisting the well-beings either, is it?
No.
Would you say that it's also fair that it wouldn't be inconsistent to use a term like enable as part of a plan provision where there is an option to do so?
My concern with the word enable is that it is stronger than assist, and therefore the arguments that can be made for that are different.
And there's two aspects to that objective, though, aren't there? So there's the enabling aspect, and then there is the reference in terms of the staging.
Yes.
So could I ask you, please, to turn to tab 11, and that's it. The reference is 501.1258. And the document is the outcome statement and principles.
1251.2. 1258.
Yes, and what part of it? Well, just have a look at the start of it. And so it's an outcome statement and principles for implementing Pseudo-Thymana. It's dated July 2015,
yes.
And you'll see there the purpose is to identify the principles that underpin the Waikato River Iwi engagement with the Healthy Rivers Plan Change, and there is the articulation of a common outcome statement. So you'll see that, have you got a hard copy or are you looking at an electronic
copy? Soft copy, yeah.
Sorry, soft copy?
Yeah.
So if you turn to page 1260, scroll down,
yes.
You'll see that there is a table there, and there are four columns, and the reason why I'm taking you to this particular part is because the following pages don't seem to have the headers, so we just need to understand what the headers are. So there's an outcome statement in the first column, followed by an explanation, then a vision and strategy objective, and then what does success look like in the fourth column. And then I'd like you to please scroll down to page 1264.
Yes.
And in the first column at the bottom of the page, it should start with the words recognise the potential,
yes,
of landowners to develop land within the water, quality limits, etc., etc. And that talks about, in the second column, the restoration and protection of the Waikato River is of paramount importance to River Iwi and the community. And it goes on to say, while it is important to put in place a flexible approach that enables the community's well-being to be met, including maintaining and enhancing economic well-being, the restoration and protection of the Waikato and Waipa rivers must not be compromised. So having regard to that wording, actually let me just go back a step. In the third column you'll see that there's a reference there to Objective A of the vision and strategy. Sorry, Objective D. Objective J and Objective F. And having have in regard to that wording that came from the River Iwi and their reference there to enablement, do you think that it's consistent with their articulation of the issue to refer to enabling communities to provide through their wellbeing through applying a staged approach?
Enabling as long as that's not superseding the need to achieve the two different manner. That's how I would read it.
Thank you. All right. In your evidence at paragraph 140, when you're talking about this objective, you say that it is more appropriate to assist people in communities rather than enable them to provide for their well-being.
I'm saying that's what PC1 does. It assists people rather than going that extra step to enabling them. That's the way I've read that.
Yes, thank you. And you refer to people in communities, don't you? In that paragraph.
Which paragraph is it?
Paragraph 140.
Yes.
Objective 3 doesn't refer to people though, does it?
No.
Whereas Dr. Mitchell's wording does refer to people.
I haven't got Dr. Mitchell's wording in front of me.
But you'll take it as correct that that is in fact what he refers to in terms of the wording change that he proposed.
Sure.
He talks about enabling people in communities.
Yes, and I mean, I would read communities as including people personally.
But you wouldn't have a problem with it referring to people and communities?
No.
Rather than just the Waikato and Waipa communities themselves?
No, I don't think that's a problem there.
Okay, thank you. So turning to policy 12, and I'll try not to jump too much around the place in relation to these three policies. There are two parts to policy 12, possibly three, but let's focus on the first two. Part one, I think it's fairly said, is where there's a requirement to demonstrate that the best practical option or BPO has been applied.
Yes.
Right. And reasonable maximum is a separate issue, but I'll come back to that. And then the second part of it in subclause B is what you have to do if your activity has a residual adverse effect, isn't it?
Yes.
And part three or subclause C establishes what the relevant considerations are, so that if you are an applicant, you know what measures should be proposed. Is that how you understand
the residual effects? Yes.
Thank you. And so that's how you understand those policies to work together. And so, just to be clear about that, the applicant only knows that they should propose those measures to address a residual adverse effect if they can see that they are likely to have one.
Yes, that's right. And so, clause C defines what a residual adverse effect is effectively.
Yes, and that's important, isn't it? Because if an applicant is going to have a residual adverse effect, then they need to know for offsetting or compensation purposes, which can be complex, what sort of proposals they are going to need to put before a hearing panel.
Okay.
And they can be expensive and difficult to implement sometimes.
Yes.
So it's not the sort of thing that you would want to be doing on the hoof, as it were.
Yes.
And if you have a look at subclause C1, This is the provision that, if you have a look at subclause C overall, there will only be a residual adverse effect if the applicant is not making the appropriate reduction in load for the contaminants in question. Is that correct?
Yes, yes, that's correct.
That's your understanding. And to be fair, the party spent significant amounts of time working through these issues, did they not?
They did.
Yes. So, in other words, when we think about these policies, if there is a trend or a step change or a series of step changes that industry has that is achieving the reductions that are required, then an applicant wouldn't need to worry about policy 12B, would they? With the proviso that they were meeting the proportionate reduction.
That's right. So they would have no residual adverse effects based on this policy.
But if there is a gap between what is required to be achieved and what the applicant intends to achieve, then that is where policy 12B starts to kick in.
Yes.
And you start to consider what you need to do.
Yes.
In terms of the words in policy 12B, measures should be proposed. That was a deliberate consideration by the hearings panel, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. And you continue to support those words?
Yes, yes, and that's explained in my evidence.
And they also generally reflect section 104B, don't they?
Yes.
So going back to this issue, there is a gap between the load reductions for a replacement consent being achieved and the load reduction that they are making. Then an applicant should propose offsetting in terms of that, the way that that policy works.
Yes.
And with respect to replacement consent, that is what Clause 5 clarifies, isn't it?
Yes.
Would you describe that as a clear expectation?
Yes, certainly.
Thank you. So, looking at policy 12B, you've got a gap. It then goes on to put boundaries around the measures that should be proposed to ensure positive effect in the sub-clauses that follow, doesn't it?
Yes.
So, leaving aside clause 1 for a moment, clause 2 relates to the contaminants, correct?
Yes.
Clause 3 is about the location of the measure.
Yes.
Clause 4 is about the duration of the measure.
Yes.
And clause 5 is about the equivalency of the measure.
Yes.
Thank you. So if we come back to clause Roman 1, that's a different sort of proviso from the rest of that list, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And it refers to the primary discharge.
Yes.
So, do you understand that this policy effectively says that if there is a residual adverse effect, which you've determined in accordance with policy 12C, then measures should be proposed by the applicant unless the primary discharge has a significant or toxic adverse effect?
Yes.
And if the primary discharge did have those effects, then what would your expectation of a consent applicant be under those circumstances?
Well, I guess the consent applicant would need to explain the extent of those effects and the significance of those effects.
Would you see that as a situation where it meant that the applicant didn't have to do anything?
No, I don't think so. And just pointing out that in terms of those sorts of effects, as you say, this is kind of a different clause to the other ones. In terms of those kind of effects, there's a number of other policies and objectives in the plan that need to be looked at if that was the case, that those effects seem to be apparent.
Okay. outlier in that sense, isn't it?
It is, yes.
So if you don't meet subclause 1, are you seeing this as a situation where a consent might not be granted?
That's a possibility, yes.
Would you say then, in your view, that policy 12B effectively operates as a bottom line?
Yes, I think that's true. You know, within the meaning of the words, have regard to and so on, things at the end.
So there are two key propositions in policy 12. The first is, as we've discussed, that the BPO is applied,
yes.
And the second is about managing residual adverse effects.
Yes.
Do you see that both of these issues are effectively bottom line?
Yes, I think that's how they're written. Again, again referring to the policy words and the Act's words around how these would be implemented in a particular case.
So, in that situation, if you were not able to meet one of those bottom line provisions, then would you then have, or would you then have regard to policy 11 and policy 13?
Yes.
So,
yes, generally.
So you see there's a situation where an applicant is struggling to get through the tests in, or the directions in policy 12.
Yeah.
And so then you would have recourse to policy 11 to look at whether the discharge was coming from regionally significant industry or regionally significant infrastructure.
Yes.
And you would then consider policy 13 matters that might be relevant to the question of whether consent should be granted.
Yes, I think that's true.
Thank you.
In a sense, just to make it clear my view of this, I don't necessarily see policy 12 as a gateway, because as you explain it, it's all embedded in section 104, have regard to these matters.
So, in that sense, it's about considering those three policies in the round, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, I think so. That's how I read it.
And you can't consider one policy in isolation from another, because they're all important.
I think that's true.
Likewise, you couldn't just look at policy 11 and say, well, that's a gateway for regionally significant industry and infrastructure. We don't need to have a look at policy 12 or policy
13. That's how I read it, yes.
In terms of policy 11, there is a proposal by Ms. Ma to remove the word subject to the need to achieve objective 1 from policy 11. And
yes.
Your position is that this is not appropriate?
Just repeat that question.
So Ms. Ma proposes to remove the word subject to the need to achieve objective 1. Oh, sorry, I think I got that wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Subject to policies 12 and 13 and having regard to the need to achieve the
objective. She wants it to read subject to policies 12 and 13 and the need to achieve objective 1.
Yes, I disagree with that.
Yes, and just to be clear, for the record, it's about taking out the words having regard.
That's right.
And you note that a consent officer needs to have regard to Objective 1 and Policy 11 under Section 104.1 of the RMA and MEZ, don't you?
Yes.
So those considerations would still need to be had even if Objective 1 wasn't referred to in that policy.
Yes.
And just a final question in relation to mixing zones. further to policy 8, which is 3.2.4.8, do you want to pull that up, Your Honour?
Policy 8.
Yes, policy 8. The reference is 501.061.
501.0616.
Continues over the following page, and there are a number of considerations regarding the matters listed therein. As a general proposition, would you agree that a point source discharge will have a mixing zone?
It will have a mixing zone, yes.
And so the question about the size of that mixing zone, isn't it?
It's, there are two aspects here, if I can explain. Yes, it's about the extent of areas where adverse effects would otherwise be unacceptable. My view of mixing zones is they make sense for chemical, physical characteristics of water, biological ecosystem. They make less sense for cultural, spiritual impacts on motive of water.
And so in your view, you don't think that there's enough of that consideration in Policy 8 with respect to those latter matters?
Sorry, you're looking at Policy 8 of...
of the regional plan?
Yes.
In relation to that, the reasonable mixing policy. Would you like to...
Oh, sorry, no, I've got that in my head more or less. Yeah, so policy 8 is about how do you establish what a reasonable mixing zone is.
About the size of it.
It doesn't talk about whether there should be any reasonable mixing zone, whether that's acceptable. And again, that turns to me on whether we're talking about physical kind of things or physical attributes or spiritual, cultural, Māori type of things.
And in terms of the conversation that we've just been having about Policy 11 and the extent to which you would have regard to other policies, other objectives in the plan in considering that policy, is it not true that the same would apply in relation to the reasonable mixing policy?
Well, it is true, but there's no statement anywhere else in the plan that I'm aware of where there's an assessment of whether any size reasonable mixing zone is okay or not.
Thank you, Mr. Cabilco. I have nothing further to
thank you.
Witness.
Thank you, Mr. Chapman. Mr. Muldowney.
Good morning, Mr. Trudoga.
Good morning.
I'll just preface my questions by saying that I'm just recovering from a bout of flu, so if I do cough and sputter, my apologies. I'll endeavour to keep it suppressed as best I can. I want to, if I can, Mr. Trudoga, just pick up on this reasonable mixing zone point that my friend finished with. And start with the policy intent of Policy 12. So my understanding is Policy 12 really provides the overall framework for the management of point source discharges. Do you agree?
Yes, it does.
And that's primarily based on adopting the best practicable option to manage the discharge and then requiring offsetting or compensation to address any residual effects.
Yes.
And Policy 12A requires that when applying for consent, the applicant would need to demonstrate that the BPO is preventing or minimising adverse effects of the discharge.
Yes.
And in terms of how that adverse effect is measured, you now accept that and recommend that assessment or measurement occurs after a zone of reasonable mixing. Is that correct?
I don't quite read it that way. I mean, from my old days as a consent officer, where I did process a lot of applications for wastewater discharges, when we were talking about BPO in those days, we were focusing on what can be done to minimise contaminants in that discharge before the discharge gets to the receiving environment. So it was all about what kind of treatment technologies are available and were used, the kind of discharge, land discharge, directed water, whether it goes through rock trench and all the rest of that. And I guess I'm still quite influenced by that process where reducing or minimising the adverse effects was about what you tried to do before you got into the water, before the discharge got to the water. And then it was a question of, so, okay, we've done the best we can. What's an acceptable size for what would be otherwise unacceptable effects? That's a different question in my mind. It's not that I don't... Yes, you can read it in a way as BPO in a very broad sense. But that's the way I would read it, because then you're looking at the whole water context and the social, you know, context of the water, the way it's used in that location, which is a little bit different in my view to what's BPO. It's more a technical issue.
The words that you seek to introduce to Policy 12A, though, we just focus on those.
Yeah.
You accept that when it comes to the point of measuring the water quality against standards that are established.
Yes.
That measurement should occur after a zone of reasonable mixing.
From that point of view, yes, I generally accept that. It's normal to allow some reasonable mixing for that. As I said before, that doesn't really address the cultural issue.
Yes. I understood that part of your answer to my friend's question. Can we just then explore the way that one would arrive at a zone of reasonable mixing?
Yes.
You accept, I think, as a matter of fact, that there is always a mixing zone where
yes.
two liquid bodies come together.
Sure.
And in the context of a flowing river, that zone will be some point in the reach of the river between the point source discharge and some point further down the river, won't it?
Yes.
And the extent of that mixing zone will be, and what is deemed reasonable, will be assessed based on a range of factors. But in short, the more toxic and offensive the contaminant, the likelihood that the mixing zone is going to be shorter. Is that right?
Yes. The reasonable mixing zone is shorter, yes.
But there are wider considerations in determining what would be reasonable. You accept that, don't you?
Yes.
And so the regional policy statement deals with this at, I think my friend pointed you to, it's policy 3.2.38.
Regional plan, does
it? Oh, regional plan, I apologize, yeah. And do you have that policy 8 in front of you?
Yes, I do.
So my reading of the policy indicates that it establishes firstly two key concepts. First, that you should minimise the mixing zone as far as possible. As a starting proposition, do you accept that?
Yes.
And secondly, that what is deemed reasonable is to be determined on a case-by-case basis.
In terms of size, yes.
And then the policy sets out a non-exhaustive list of considerations that should also be taken account of.
Yes.
And you've mentioned in your previous answers that you think that it seems to do a reasonable job of dealing with those biophysical elements of what might be deemed a reasonable mixing zone, but not necessarily the cultural elements. Is that right?
Yes.
Can I just ask you to read items J and K in the list? J talks about any effects of the mixing zone on other users of the water body, and K deals with the extent of adverse effects within the mixing zone.
Yes.
You accept that within those criteria sits those cultural elements that you're talking about?
You could say that. It still is only talking about how big the area should be. It is difficult because whatever wording we use, what we're trying to say is that there are some cases where a discharge, no matter, even if there was, you know, that much mixing zone, it still doesn't address the at least even the perceptual issue. If there are people swimming just downstream from it, it's not about size in that case, or it becomes zero size kind of thing is the only acceptable size. So whatever wording we're trying to sort of get in there, that's my intention of trying to address that by allowing that discussion of, is the discharge appropriate even with zero mixing zone effectively?
Well, just let's stay with that part of your answer. If under policy 8 the mixing zone is deemed to be only reasonable if it is zero or close to zero, I don't think it can be zero, because I think you've accepted that there's always a zone of mixing, just as a matter of...
But that's a different issue. There is always, in any case, a zone of mixing. What's reasonable is what we're talking about here.
Yes. So, policy 8 would allow you to determine that the reasonable mixing zone in a particular situation might be zero or something close to it, correct?
Yes. I don't read policy 8 as being framed that way. I read it more as, you can have some kind of reasonable mixing zone. Let's talk about how big it should be. So that's how I kind of read the interpretation of that policy 8, which in terms of Te Tiriti Whā Mana and what it's trying to achieve, I don't think goes far enough, and that's why in order to address the issue that WRA, the statutory body, set up to achieve Te Tiriti Whā Mana, in order to address their issue, the question of appropriateness needs to be considered alongside any questions about size, which is what 3238 talks about.
But you accept that size could be zero?
Well, I do, yes. I'm just saying that the kind of the nature of that policy 3238, I don't think it's really talking directly to that point, though, of cultural effects. That's the way I see that. That's why I read that.
But you accept that what Policy 8 can lead you to is a full consideration of all relevant environmental effects associated with the discharge?
Yes, I can see you can read it that way. Whether that gives the right direction, the strength of direction that I think Titiri Vaimata is asking for, I'm less sure about that. I understand what you're saying, and you're quite right, it can be read that way.
Well, do you accept that the concept of reasonable and the concept of appropriate are synonyms?
I don't accept that the concept of a reasonable size of a mixing zone is synonymous with any mixing. In other words, should the discharge be there at all, in fact,
but
if it's creating some kind of effect on the river.
Well, but if the assessment under Policy 8 is to determine the extent of a mixing zone,
yeah,
and for cultural reasons under Policy 8 that is deemed to be zero...
Yes, Policy 8 doesn't talk about cultural effects as such or Māori effects as such.
No, but we've accepted that, so you've accepted that items J and K capture those effects.
I'm saying it could be read that way.
Well, it talks about any effects.
Yes, I
understand. How could it possibly be read any other way?
I read that, but I think that's a very kind of roundabout, weak way of stating a policy direction that I think is important. And I think we need to strengthen it.
So, is it your evidence that you could, a resource user could find himself in a position where they've established a reasonable mixing zone which is deemed inappropriate?
Well, I don't think it's up to the resource user necessarily to establish the reasonable mixing zone. It needs to be a discussion and a decision made through the consent process.
Yes. Well, it makes its case through the consent process.
Yes.
And let's say, with the acceptance of the regulator, a reasonable mixing zone is established under Policy 8.
Yes.
Are you suggesting that that reasonable mixing zone can, on the one hand, be deemed reasonable and, on the other, inappropriate?
If that's the case, is that, as you say, that the consent officer has agreed that there is a certain reasonable mixing zone that is reasonable, then it must be appropriate as well.
So if that's your answer, there is a redundancy, isn't there, in your proposed drafting, which talks about an appropriate reasonable mixing zone.
I still don't see that's the case. We have consent officers needing policy guidance as to how to interpret these policies. And I would feel more comfortable if that was a clearer policy guidance with respect to those spiritual cultural effects. I don't see that clearly stated, even though I agree with you that it can be read that way under 3238.
But you talk of clarity, but where's the clarity for resource users and for those administering the plan in determining, on the one hand, under Policy 8, a mixing zone which is reasonable and which takes into account cultural effects under items J and K, only to then find themselves in a position where the erstwhile reasonable mixing zone is now deemed inappropriate in terms of Policy 12A. Where's the clarity in that?
Well, the first point to me is that appropriateness needs to come first. Is it appropriate to have a reasonable mixing zone? And then, before deciding on how big it should be, and that appropriateness is will be determined in terms of the other objectives of the regional policy statement and the plan, objectives like maintain or enhance Māori of fresh water, protect the health and well-being of Waikato River, or health and well-being of Waikato River, restored and protected, and so on. So, to me, those policy objective guidance that's already there provides reasonable clarity as to when it's appropriate and when it's not. Whether that's strong enough, I'm not sure. You're right. The hearing panel kind of was quite clear that the appropriateness sort of turns on the on the relationship between people and the river at that point, and that's how it should be established. Whether that needs to be clarified further in the plan, I'm not sure.
Well, my proposition is that the appropriateness that you speak of is determined under Policy 8 when considering items J and K, and that once you determine that appropriateness in that context, it doesn't need a second layer of consideration under Policy 12A. Once it's deemed reasonable, it's appropriate, and that's the end of the debate.
Yes, I hear your argument. I'm just not entirely buying into that. I don't see it that way.
I mean, isn't your introduction of the word appropriate as a prefix to reasonable mixing in Policy 12A just a sort of backdoor way of actually making a change to Policy 8?
No, I think it's adding another test, if you like, to the test of reasonable mixing. I mean,
well, that's what I mean.
Yeah, and I mean, WRA's request, their whole point was that there should never be a reasonable mixing zone. No mixing zone is appropriate, was the what they were asking for.
Well, they've moved on from that, though, haven't they?
I'm not sure to the extent that they have. It still seems an important point that I think you're right that they accept the practicalities that at times there probably does need to be a reasonable exit zone, but that still should be tested, and that's what the word appropriate is for. Therefore,
well, do you accept that this sort of two-stage test that you're seeking to introduce adds a layer of uncertainty for resource users and plan users?
I agree it's another question that they have to address, yes. I don't know if that's uncertainty, but it's a point that needs to be addressed. That's the point of it. That's why you would put it in there.
But is it really an additional point when items J and K within Policy 8 capture the consideration that you're trying to address through the word appropriate?
Yes, well, I think I've answered that question already a number of times.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Booker. We'll move past that point. That was really, I think, one of the key issues for the territorial authorities was the removal of the word appropriate.
Yes, I certainly accept that, and so I understand that the issue and the concern about it.
Yes. Well, thank you for your answers on that point. And I think what I can say to you is that apart from that particular word, the introduction to the concept of reasonable mixing within Policy 12A is welcomed by the territorial authorities.
Yes, thank you.
So I just want to now just deal with very briefly some of the other policy amendments that the territorial authorities have sought and which have been addressed by you, I think, principally in your evidence and rebuttal. The first is in relation to Policy 13, and that's the policy which addresses the matters to be taken into account when considering a resource consent application. And you've agreed to some additional wording which expressly recognises the unique role and function of territorial authorities, haven't you?
Yes.
And as between territorial authorities and yourself, you understand there to be no ongoing debate in relation to the wording that's been suggested by you?
That's right.
Yes. Thank you. And equally, in terms of Policy 14, that's the policy that deals with relevant considerations for the duration of consent. You also recommended the adoption of some additional language which again recognises the role and function of territorial authorities in that domain.
Yes.
And again, your understanding is there's no issues with the proposed drafting as between the region and the territorial authorities.
That's right. Thank you.
And then just finally, in terms of some of the edits and amendments that territorial authorities were seeking, the first was just in relation to the definition of regionally significant infrastructure.
Yes.
Now, the point there was that there seems to be, that term is already defined in the operative regional policy statement, but there appears to be a gap in the extent that it doesn't reference stormwater expressly.
Yes.
You're aware of that?
Yes.
I think it's, not sure if you've got the definition handy.
I haven't. I've got some idea of it.
Yeah, I mean, item I in the definition talks about municipal waste water treatment plants and water supply treatment plants and bulk water supply, wastewater storage systems, etc. But it just doesn't deal with stormwater.
That's right.
So the territorial authorities were seeking that to be addressed. Before I talk to you about the proposed wording, there is a slightly oblique reference to stormwater, which is, it comes via the reference to lifeline utilities. Are you aware of that?
Yes.
Yes. So lifeline utilities are recorded as regionally significant infrastructure, and then when one goes to the definition of that in the Civil Defence Emergency Management Act 2002, it captures stormwater systems and utilities. You're aware of that?
Yes.
So there's this sort of roundabout way that stormwater is included within the definition.
Yes, but it's not completely open-ended. It's talking about lifeline utilities and associated essential infrastructure. And the question in my mind and in the panel's mind has always been, is all stormwater essential infrastructure? Is every grade and culvert an essential part of that? And that was the question they were asking. And so my feeling is that, and particularly because we're trying to achieve the objectives of PC1, if we want to argue for what's regionally significant, to me it's better to do that next year through the threshold policy review, where we can talk about the whole region. We don't end up having a part of the plan that says for this area, stormwater is regionally significant, but for everywhere else, it may or may not be. It creates a real problem to me. I think we can have a much better discussion in the threshold policy review of this issue, which is the only reason I'm not disagreeing with you that a lot of stormwater is regionally significant. It's very true. But I just don't believe this is the right place to have that discussion about what the regional plan should say about that.
Well, in terms of your first objection and that of the panel, the evidence for the territorial authorities is that you can't really disaggregate a stormwater network in the way that you've described, in the sense that there's some parts that are regionally significant and one particular culvert or grade,
yeah,
or whatever that isn't.
Yes.
It's an integrated network,
yes,
which functions in a regionally, as a regionally significant infrastructure. What do you say to that proposition?
Well, I do agree with that, but I haven't thought enough about all the aspects of that network, if you like, and the extent to which all of that should be included in the PC1 area as regionally significant or not. So I accept your point that at a high level it is a network, and it's all important in terms of lifelines anyway. But I just still think, I mean, yes, you could argue that, and we could make this change for Chapter 11, but I just don't see that that's the best way to do this and the best way to have that discussion, where the kind of evidence that's needed to establish what's actually significant here, what's reasonably significant in terms of stormwater. We haven't had that debate, and we haven't had evidence supporting that debate. I just think, why can't we wait for a year and have the proper debate?
And is your other objection to the drafting edit just simply a question of tidy drafting, in the sense that it feels like it's a definition that will extend to stormwater in relation to Chapter 3, but not necessarily other chapters in the plan? Is that the concern here?
Well, it certainly opens up that debate about why is it significant here, but not for the rest of the region. It's a minor point, probably. I don't know who would use that argument, but it would be an anomaly in the plan, I think.
But you agree that it would be tidier to, when we're dealing with the definition of regionally significant infrastructure, to deal with those municipal three waters networks as a whole?
Well, in principle, yes, but like I say, I haven't seen the evidence of that. I think I'd like to see it and hear it before making a call of that significance.
And then finally, Mr. Zabulco, it was just the definition of point source discharge itself. There had been a concern raised by Mr. Ryan, the planner for Hamilton City, that in a very technical sense, a discharge from a culvert, a fixed point within the network, could meet the definition of a point source discharge.
Yes.
And then lead the territorial authorities to a point where they're having to address consents for those point source discharges within the network. You've responded to that by saying you think that's a sort of an extremely sort of remote prospect of the definition being interpreted in that way. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. It's not that it's not within the words, you could read it that way, but the regional council has much better things to do than try and consent a discharge from a culvert that's really just a pipe in the middle of a stream and allow traffic to go over it. I can't see that it's a realistic problem. It hasn't occurred, to the best of my knowledge, in all the years that these provisions have been in place in the past. And therefore, I don't see that you would add words to a definition to address an improbable problem. That's the way I see it. It just kind of mixes up the definition. Perhaps we could add lots of other improbable things that it should talk about. I just don't see it's necessary to do that.
That's understood. Do you, within the regional council, have guidance notes or standard operating sort of procedures that might record an institutional position on things of this nature?
Yes, the resource use group has that kind of guidance. It's been many years since I've been part of that group, so I'm not sure what's actually available now, but that's what they do, yes.
And based on the evidence that you've given this morning, would you be prepared to go back to that group with the position that you've taken in evidence today?
I've got no problem telling them this is an issue that's arisen, and having that discussion with them, yes.
Well, if it leads the territorial authorities to not pursue the point any further with the court.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Right. Yes, no problem with that.
Thank you, Mr. Trebulco.
Thank you very much.
I have no further questions, Your Honour. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mulder. Does the phrase point source discharge need a definition? What is unusual about those words?
That's right. Well, there is a definition.
I know there is.
Yeah.
But what I'm asking you is, I mean, planners put definitions in plans.
Yes, sir.
When, and it creates, because then lawyers read the definitions, or the glossary, as the regional council seems to want to call this definition. And the lawyers then say, well, here's money, we'll have an argument over this definition, when a point source discharge is a point source discharge.
Yes, it's obvious to me what it means without having it defined.
Well, I just don't know that they're unusual words or terms of art. I see a microbial pathogen is defined as a microorganism capable of inducing illness in humans, so it is what a microbial pathogen is. I'm sorry, I went through this with the Auckland Unitary Plan, had huge arguments with every single, you know, house should be defined, and
yes,
road should be defined. You know. Sorry, just wait for morning tea. Mr. Cassidy, any questions?
No further questions, sir.
No, thank you. Mr. Malone. Thank you. Ms. Garvin.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. You may need to move to the lectern where we can get you on the speech-to-text device, if that's convenient for you.
one. All right.
Mr. Tabralco, Policy 12 does not state that resource consent applications for point source discharges must be granted, does it?
No.
And the Regional Council will be able to decline a discretionary application for resource consent for point source discharges under Section 104B of the RMA, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you. No one here for Bathurst? No. Mr. Minher?
No questions, Your Honour.
Thank you very much. Ms. Ongley?
Yes, good morning. Do you agree as a general proposition that a good regional plan tries to resolve conflicts on its face rather than leaving it to a case-by-case decision maker?
Yes.
And so some parties are seeking that the words subject to policies 12 and 13 and policy 11 be removed and the words subject to policy 12 and policy 13 be removed. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
But those words are useful, aren't they? Because they provide a decision maker on a resource consent the ability to see which policies should be elevated over others?
Yes, I believe so.
Just going to this issue of reasonable mixing. So, policy 12, and I should clarify, I'm looking at the post-conferencing version here that was attached to Mr. Conway's legal submissions.
Yes.
So the words after any appropriate reasonable mixing occurs in accordance with policy 3.2.3.8 and policy 12A were not included in the decisions version. They've been included by you due to some parties asking where does reasonable mixing fit in here?
Yes.
And you've added the word appropriate, as you've said, because the Waikato River Authority has a concern that in some cases it will not be appropriate to have a mixing zone at all.
That's right.
Now, the problem is, though, in policy 12A, which talks about primarily the best practicable option, adding the words after any appropriate reasonable mixing occurs indicates that the BPO doesn't apply to your consideration of the reasonable mixing zone.
Yes.
Is that your view, that the BPO doesn't apply to considerations of the reasonable mixing zone?
As I tried to explain earlier, the way I see that is BPO is about minimising impacts or contaminants in a discharge before it gets to the receiving environment. And then there's a discussion about should there be a mixing zone, is it allowable, how big should it be? So it's the area where adverse effects are acceptable, or for this case, to deal with practicality type issues.
The definition of BPO in the Act, though, isn't it, is that you look at the nature of the discharge and the sensitivity of the receiving environment,
yes,
the financial implications, mm-hmm, and the effect of the environment of that option when compared to other options,
yes,
and the current state of technical knowledge and likelihood that the options can be successfully applied.
Yes.
And so by removing that from the consideration of reasonable mixing, somebody may read that as meaning that you don't look at those considerations when you're looking at a reasonable mixing zone.
I don't quite see that that's the case.
All right, so you don't agree with the fairness in the joint witnesses statement, Mr. Ryan, Ms. Maher, Ms. Kizik, Ms. Sweetman, and Mr. Hamilton, that the policy should read, require demonstration that the proposed discharge, including any reasonable mixing, represents the BPO.
That's right.
Right. If we can turn to policy 12, the sub-Roman numeral 1.
Yes.
Now, this is another addition that wasn't in the decisions version. Decision's version says the primary discharge does not result in the discharge having either significant adverse effects on aquatic life or toxic adverse effects. What do you think was meant there by the words "the primary discharge"?
I see that as meaning the discharge from the plant, usually a treatment plant. So it's a pipe discharge from there, as opposed to any discharges from areas used for offsetting and compensation. And so I see that difference as quite useful.
I see. You don't think it might have meant the discharge after reasonable mixing? No, that's all right.
No, I don't. I see it as the primary discharge coming from the plant. That's the way I've read that anyway till now.
So, Ms. Ma and Ms. Kizik's view is that the decision makers purposefully excluded significant adverse effects on aquatic life or toxic adverse effects from this policy, which relates to offsetting,
yes,
due to deterring fire manner, indicating that those effects after reasonable mixing will not be appropriate in the PC1 region, area?
Yes, I think that's true.
And you don't agree with that view?
Well, whether it's after reasonable mixing or within the zone mixing, then we have to have that discussion about is it acceptable on a case-by-case basis, having regard to the guidance in these policies.
Okay, so do you accept the view that Tsuri Faimana indicates that after reasonable mixing, the discharge should not have significant adverse effects on aquatic life or toxic adverse effects?
I don't think Tsuri Faimana mentions reasonable mixing from him.
All right, but you indicated that you would need to have a discussion about before within the mixing zone versus outside the mixing zone.
Yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, if it's established that there are toxic adverse effects or significant effects, that then leads to the discussion of how significant, how big, what's okay, what's not, is any effect not okay, based on the guidance here. That's and again, thinking back to my days of consent processing, that's the kind of thinking that would go through that process.
All right, so you would leave it open, in summary, you would leave it open to say that you can have those effects either within the mixing zone or outside the mixing zone, and that gets considered on a case-by-case basis.
Yes, I mean, that particular direction, policy direction, doesn't talk about mixing zones, so I'm not really sure what the intent was, whether it was after or before a mixing zone.
And when you consider it on a case-by-case basis, of course, you're guided by Section 107, subsection 2.
That's right.
Right. Do you consider that is contrary to the both Tauri Whanau and also the limits on offsetting contained in the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management?
Is Section 107.2 in the system? Are you asking?
the availability of the exceptions in section 172 to allow significant adverse effects on aquatic life and toxic adverse effects. Have you considered the limits on offsetting and the NPCFM in that respect?
As I've said many times, offsetting in the NPCFM is very different to the kind of offsetting we're talking about here. But either way, inconsistent or not, it is an allowance of the Act. So it's a fact.
Just touching on that point that you made, do you not consider that the provisions here should give effect to the offsetting provisions in the NPCFM that have been introduced recently?
We're having a discussion around offsetting of aquatic effects as defined in the NPCFM, then yes, it's relevant. But we're not having that discussion. We're talking about a particular kind of offsetting and compensation as defined in Policy 12C. So, we've discussed this many times, but it's a very different kind of offsetting in my mind. So, the kind of principles that the NPCFM has that relates to a particular kind of offsetting and compensation, they don't apply in this case. Very different things, in my view.
All right, thank you.
Can we take a break now? Yes, would that be convenient? I just realised that clock seems to be running a bit slow. Based on it, we'll take 15 minutes and we'll turn around.